You've been hearing how some big brands are winning through simplicity. But don't get intimidated. You can do this too, no matter the size of your team or your budget. Want to learn the 6 behaviors you can instill to create simple experiences for your customers and your team members? Download a free copy of my Simple Playbook today. It'll help you immediately turn your customer experience around and create an Amazon experience without having an Amazon budget. Grab your copy of my Simple Playbook at mattlyles.com/simpleplaybook.
Welcome to the Simple Brand Podcast, the show dedicated to helping you create simple experiences for your customers and for your team members. Each week, we're bringing you amazing interviews with business leaders and authors who will teach you how to differentiate your business with the one thing your customers need the most. Simplicity. Your customers live in a complex world. Let's make it simple. Now here's your host, Matt Lyles.
I want you to take a moment and think about innovation. Think about an innovative company. All right, you got it? You got it in your head? Okay. If you're like most people, you're probably thinking about Tesla or Apple or Google or Amazon or any other tech giant. And that's who we tend to associate innovation with. And we tend to think that a small percentage of the population drives innovation and that innovation comes through big technical breakthroughs. But that's simply not true. In fact, a study from Harvard shows that 72% of the United States GDP comes from little ideas. Everyday people creating everyday innovations. Innovation doesn't have to be technological innovation. In your business, it's simply a new way to change your customer's experience, or a way to meet future customers' needs. Or it's simply a way to change your team's processes to help them operate more effectively. It turns out everyone has the ability to be creative and has the ability to create innovations. Innovations in their customer experience, innovations in their own internal work, and even innovations in their personal life. The challenge comes in that most people don't even recognize their ability to be creative, and they don't understand how to exercise or hone their creative thinking skills. And that's why I'm glad I talked with Josh Linkner this week. Josh is the number one most booked innovation keynote speaker. He's a professional-level jazz guitarist, and he's a New York Times best-selling author of multiple books, with his latest book coming out today, Big Little Breakthroughs: How Small Everyday Innovations Drive Oversized Results. In Big Little Breakthroughs, Josh dispels the myth that innovation comes from big tech companies or from super smart geeks in hoodies off in some secret tech lab. In fact, everyone, including you and your team, has the ability to be innovative and creative. And Josh and I discussed this along with key habits and exercises to help you and your team create your own breakthroughs and create innovations that'll exponentially help your business. So here it is, my interview with Josh Linkner. Hi, Josh. How are you? How are things going in Detroit, Rock City?
You know, things are great. And speaking of Rock City, I know you're in Nashville and what an amazing town you're in. We both are very privileged to be in cool music cities.
I think so. Oh my goodness. There's so much going on in Nashville, or at least there was when I first moved here. Not so much the past year, but things are starting to pick up.
Well, I think there's some light at the end of the tunnel. The vaccinations are really rolling out, and I know we still have some challenges ahead, but it sure is encouraging at least to see where we're headed.
Oh yeah. I'm looking forward to more live music. I'm looking forward to traveling for more conferences and events. I'm sure you are too. But one of the things that we're able to do in the meantime to learn from each other is to read. And I have been reading a lot of books lately, and I was super excited about Big Little Breakthroughs and had a chance to read that this past week. So thank you very much. This is your fourth book, right?
It is. Yeah. Book number 4. And I got to say, you know, books are like kids. You're proud of all of them, hopefully. But this one is really special to me. I put over 1,000 hours into the research and writing of the book. And I really think it's the best thing I've written. I think it has, you know, sort of high artistic integrity. I'm certainly no Hemingway or anything, but it does to me, at least, you know, I'm very proud of it. So I'm glad that you had a chance to check it out.
Books are like kids, or like being able to like birth a new kid or a new project, but probably when it's, when your book is 11 or 12 years old, it's not going to start talking back to you.
That's exactly right.
But reading Big Little Breakthroughs, it's all about innovation and creativity. And when we tend to think of innovation, we usually think of those big innovative tech companies, or we think of individuals like Elon Musk or Tony Stark or Mark Zuckerberg. But Big Little Breakthroughs challenges that notion. So what have you found out there that helps us rethink innovation?
Yeah, that's really what I set out to do. I mean, the book is designed to help everyday people become everyday innovators. And what we've learned, a couple of things, it flips the whole premise of innovation upside down. Most of us think that for innovation to really count, it has to be a $1 billion idea, or that only certain roles are allowed to be innovative. Like you can only be creative if you're wearing a lab coat or a hoodie. But the truth is that we all are creative as human beings. That's our natural state. And the human mind, we're sort of hardwired to be creative. And so that's what I tried to set out, is how can we help normal people, you know, all walks of life, careers, et cetera, tap into the same superpower and really reframe who can be the face of innovation. Instead of the face of innovation being Elon Musk or some other tech billionaire, why can't it be you and me and us normal folks? Because when we get creative, better outcomes follow.
And I think most people likely feel like they're not creative or innovative. So how can we help those normal people, those everyday people, understand how they are creative or understand how to be more creative?
Well, you're exactly right. And to me, it breaks my heart a little bit. I mean, you've never met an uncreative four-year-old. Right. But over time, our well-intentioned parents and schools and teachers and bosses, they kind of beat it out of us. And we're so worried not to make any mistakes that we stop taking any chances. So what I did in the book is try to lay out a very deliberate path on how we can actually cultivate and develop those skills. The good news is that creativity is much more like your weight than your height. For me, as try as I may, I'm probably not going to grow a foot by next month. But my weight I can control based on my exercise and nutrition, et cetera. And creativity is the same thing. It's a skill that all of us can cultivate and develop and grow.
It's kind of like a muscle. You can either, you know, exercise and build it, or you can let it get weak with atrophy.
That is exactly what it is. And in the book, I actually lay out, it's really a very practical field guide. So there's a lot of fun stories and it's inspiring and all that, but there's like very deliberate, like what do you do when you wake up in the morning to get more creative? And what we've learned are a couple of cool things. One is it really doesn't take years of study or millions of dollars or huge sacrifices. Because it's our natural state, we can reconnect with it pretty quickly. You may have heard of the 10,000 hour rule, which was popularized by Malcolm Gladwell.
Right.
Which in the game of telephone, it really was originally, you know, what does it take to be a master? But it got to misconstrued that it takes 10,000 hours basically to learn a new skill. But in the book, I actually talk about something called the 20-hour rule, which was popularized by a guy named Josh Kaufman. Basically, that says this: if you want to get not masterful, but pretty darn good at just about any skill, not brain surgery, obviously, but creativity is certainly one. If you have 20 hours of deliberate focus and practice, you actually can get pretty good. Like you can learn a couple chords on a guitar and learn to strum a song. You can learn to, you know, enough knowledge to be dangerous in just about any field. So what I really challenge people to do is just to invest 20 hours. Doesn't have to be all at once. You don't have to take time off work. It could be over a period of months, but a little bit of extra focus, deliberate focus and practice can yield monumental results. And the cool thing is that creativity is a high leverage activity if you scale it. In other words, if you get 5% more creativity, your career might be 100% better. If you get 5% more creative, your relationships might be 600% better. And so investing in growing your creative skill just a little bit can yield a completely disproportionately good set of results.
I teach individuals about being able to grow their company's brand or even grow their personal brand. And it's really difficult to try and do that with just one really big campaign or even like one Super Bowl ad. But it's a lot easier to do that with small, deliberate actions over time. If you mirror that, like say to the finance industry, it's kind of like dollar cost averaging, where if you're investing a set little amount consistently over time, and that's going to help it really grow instead of trying to do like just one action one time.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. And the book, that's why it's called Big Little Breakthroughs. It's not encouraging people to take these swing for the fences, wildly risky, you know, things that can, you know, backfire in a horrible way. It's quite the opposite, really. It's about cultivating a daily habit of small, really micro innovations, these little daily creative acts. And it's a more productive approach to creativity. And here's why. First of all, it de-risks the process. It's way less risky. You're not betting your career or your company or your kids' future on one idea. You're doing lots of small ones. But second of all, those small ones, they add up to big stuff. And you're right, there's this compounding interest nature to it that if you have a lot of small wins, they add up to meaningful ones. Furthermore, you're developing the skill along the way. So the best way to get good at just about anything in life is practice. And so instead of, you know, once a decade, you get all creative and try one big, giant, risky idea, here, because you're practicing the skill on a regular basis, you're actually, we talked about that creativity muscle, you're building your creativity muscle. And finally, big little breakthroughs are accessible to us all. You don't have to be a tech billionaire. You don't have to be the CEO of your company. Any one of us can apply these in our careers, in our businesses, in our lives, even in our communities. And so it makes, it's sort of like innovation for the rest of us. It's a very sort of low risk way to get creative and enjoy the results that doing so will provide.
And I love how you say that it's accessible to us all. I mean, and if you think of a company, I mean, I think that anyone can apply these from the C-suite all the way to the frontline team members. But there has to be, you know, something that helps people understand it's not just a switch that you flip or a switch that you turn on, and those that aren't in the practice or in the habit of being innovative can't just sit down and say, okay, today I'm going to sit down and I'm going to be innovative. Okay, come to me, innovation. There's, and you refer to them as core obsessions. And I think these obsessions have been crafted and written in a way to that they are accessible to everyone. So talk to me about these core obsessions.
Yeah. So in preparation for the book, I interviewed people all over the world. I interviewed CEOs, billionaires, celebrity entrepreneurs, Grammy award-winning musicians, as well as many sort of fascinating people that most of us have never heard of, everyday innovators. And what I found is that there are some very common patterns, common mindsets of the most innovative people on the planet. And the cool thing is that they're not difficult. It does, again, it's not like, you know, you have to learn rocket science or something. These are pretty instinctive once you lay them out. And so the back eight chapters of the book, one for each obsession, there's these eight obsessions of everyday innovators. And it's kind of how people can think, which are totally portable, by the way. Any one of us who reads the book can apply these principles in their own lives. And it was fun working on it. And some of them are counterintuitive, but I think they're a lot of fun. I'm just giving you a couple quick examples. One of the principles is start before you're ready, which is basically the notion of don't wait. You know, don't wait for permission. Don't wait for a directive. Don't wait till your game plan is bulletproof. You just get started. And there's a real beauty in getting after something, even if you don't have all the things figured out. Realizing that you're going to need to course correct in real time. You're going to have to pivot along the way. If you're going to screw something up, and you'll have to pivot a bit. But it's those that get started on things are the ones that ultimately discover provocative ideas. There's a couple other fun ones. One is called use every drop of toothpaste, which is the notion of being, thank you. It's the notion of being scrappy and resourceful. It's not relying, not needing to have a huge amount of external resources to get creative. It's funny. I get this all the time. You know, I talk to companies all over the world, big and small. And I often hear, hey, I would love to be more creative, but, and then here you wait for it. They're like, I don't have enough of, and then there's like a fill in the blank. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough bandwidth. I don't have enough people. I don't have enough raw materials, whatever. But the thing I always challenge them in a loving way is that, you know, if the amount of external resources equaled your level of creativity, the federal government would be the most creative organization on the planet. And startups would be the least. And we know exactly the opposite is true. So this principle, use every drop of toothpaste, is how you can use resource constraints to actually drive your creative output.
Yeah, I think there's an inverse relationship actually between resources and creativity. Actually, to help someone be more creative, I think you can put more constraints on them. We're talking here in early April. A few weeks ago was, people were all talking about Dr. Seuss. And if you think about his book, I think his most popular book, I think, was The Cat in the Hat. And that came about from applying constraints. His publisher said, okay, I bet you, I think it was like $50 or something, that that you can't write a book where you're only limited to just 50 words. And so through that constraint, he was able to create one of his most popular books.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the principles are, again, they're kind of fun. And once they click, and they're supported with all kinds of story, real world stories and research, and also tactics that people can use to really, you know, get after it. But another one that I really like is this notion of break it to fix it. So break it to fix it is the exact opposite of what we've been told. Hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. By the way, that's terrible advice. I mean, like, why would you want to wait till something is broken? So the notion here is taking a hard look at things that might be working just fine. Maybe it's the way you sell. Maybe it's your brand. Maybe it's your, you know, systems and processes for manufacturing, whatever. But the idea is taking a deliberate approach to deconstruct them, examine them, recalibrate, and then ultimately rebuild them, trying to provide basically an upgrade. And it's a sort of proactive approach to challenging things that may be working fine. And inherent in that also is the need to let go. You know, it's very hard for many of us to let go of previous successes in favor of possibility, but that's really the hallmark of innovation. And by the way, you know, one thing that I've learned is now in 30 years in business is that too often we overestimate the risk of trying something new, but we underestimate the risk of standing still. And it's those standing still, you know, the lack of action, that status quo bias that really has become fatal. I mean, how'd that work out for Pan Am Airlines or Oldsmobile? You know, so I think that that particular principle challenges people that even when things appear fine on the surface, that it's really our job to deconstruct them, to rebuild them, and to upgrade them.
And I think a lot of times when companies stand still like that, I think a lot of times it's because they've been standing still for so long. And when you let something go for so long like that, the cost to actually change becomes greater and greater the longer that you're standing still.
That's a really good observation. You know, further, I would say that right now, as we emerge, hopefully we're about to be in the post-COVID era, it's kind of an opportunity and a threat all in one. In that the COVID situation meant that the entire world hit a giant reset button. And what happened is patterns are broken. There's a famous quote, when patterns are broken, new worlds emerge. And our patterns were broken. The way we work, the way we shop, the way we eat, the way we hang out with our buddies, all of the above. And so because of that, what it's showing, and history shows, that we can't simply rely on the models of the past and expect the same results. And if anything, the COVID challenge has accelerated our need to change. And I think what we really need to do is use this as an opportunity to reimagine, to rethink the way we work and act and engage. But if we don't, I think it can be a massive threat because, again, these patterns have been broken. And if we're expecting our customers to do what they've always done, you know, we might be in for a rude awakening.
We really are. And I think whether some of these things came about because of COVID or whether COVID just kind of opened up the window or opened up the door to help us see that some things weren't being done in the ideal experience, in the ideal way, we can't expect for everyone to go back to what they refer to as, and I'm using air quotes, what they refer to as normal in a post-pandemic world.
Yeah, that is exactly right. And actually, back to the obsessions, the last obsession in the book, I borrowed the phrase from a Zen proverb, but the obsession is called fall seven times, stand eight. Right. And many of us have really gotten knocked down in COVID, both health-wise and our businesses have suffered. The economy is you know, taking a massive hit. But the principle itself is actually a little bit more complex than it sounds. So it sounds like just dogged persistence. And it's actually not that. What it refers to is the notion that, first of all, let's accept the fact that life is full of ups and downs and that setbacks, challenges, adversity, that's inevitable. That's part of the process. You're never going to discover new ideas if you have an intolerance for failed ideas. So it's sort of recognizing the role that setbacks and failure play in the innovative process and giving ourselves a little bit of compassion. You know, when other people maybe come up with a bad idea, we're not as critical, but when we do it ourselves, you know, we're brutal the way our self-talk, we beat ourselves up. So it's first of all, recognizing that that's just part of the gig. But then secondly, it's not, again, just dogged persistence. It's the notion that each time you get back off the canvas and get back in the fight, it's saying, okay, how can I let creativity guide the way? How can I be a little bit more, how can I use creative problem solving? How can I use inventive thinking so that I'm not just doing the same thing that didn't work historically, but I'm adapting and I'm changing and I'm pivoting. So it's sort of the fusion of creativity and resilience is what this principle is all about. Fall seven times, stand eight.
And being able to learn from those failures. So not saying, this was a failure, okay, let me try something else, or this was a failure, now I'm a failure. It's, okay, this was a failure, what can we learn? Now how can we change as we evolve, as we iterate?
Yeah, totally. And one thing, you know, again, I'm not suggesting, hey, let's go hug our failures or something. I'm not being all Pollyanna. You know, it stinks when you get knocked down. Let's be honest about it. But, you know, first of all, it's a learning opportunity. And second of all, it sort of makes room for something new. One thing that's kind of cool. So Ben and Jerry's, one of my favorite ice cream brands, they do something pretty cool. When a flavor could have been a very successful flavor, but it's no longer successful anymore, they bury it. But right. I don't mean like metaphorically. I mean, they literally bury it. So at the Ben and Jerry's headquarters, yeah, they have a graveyard. And so they literally take the carton of ice cream and like they have a big funeral for it. And they people toast it with champagne. They give it a eulogy. And it's this whole ceremony around letting go of what worked in the past to make room for something new. And this business funeral concept, I think, is actually really healthy. Rather than just clinging to something that's, you know, losing relevance and efficacy over the months and years, you know, at some point, you know, you call the patient, you know, you give it a nice send off. It's not a criticism, but it's making room for something new, which is, again, I think COVID is giving us a real opportunity in the post-COVID era to, you know, let go of previous successes to make room for new ones.
Oh, yeah. And you can look at an example like the Ben and Jerry's graveyard and see how they've made that a fun experience or turned it into almost a joke. But to your point, I think it showcases and it shows other people, other employees there, or even others, how it's okay to let go of something. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the franchise Gigi's Cupcakes. One of my friends is Gigi Butler, the founder. She's here in Nashville, and she has a saying that she says, called let go to grow. Sometimes you have to let go of some of your babies in order to be able to grow into something even bigger and better, or even something more suited for today.
Yeah, I just love that phrase. That's exactly right. Let go to grow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. So we've established individuals, everyday people, normal people can be creative. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got business leaders who may think, well, in my organization, these people over here are the innovators of the company. Or you may even have like functional area leaders who think, well, my team's not innovative, nor do they need to be. So how do you convince leaders to embrace creativity across the entire org?
Well, you're right. We see this all the time. You know, oh, the second floor is where the creatives are. And really, it should be all floors is where the creatives are. And, you know, people misinterpret creativity. They think that it only is, for example, like painting on canvas is creative. And so you say, oh, I don't want my finance people, you know, drawing all over the walls with purple crayons. Well, of course not. But nonetheless, you absolutely can apply creativity in finance. I'm not saying you should be fraudulent. Of course not. But why can't you be creative in the way you deliver a report, or the way you analyze data, or the way that you know inform your colleagues about implications from the numbers? Or maybe you create creative to make yourself more efficient to save time and money. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, if you think about creativity as a laser gun, most people think you should only apply it to product development, maybe to marketing. But why not apply it to reducing safety hazards in a building site, or improving efficiency in a factory? So my point is that each area really can thrive when applying creativity in an appropriate way. And again, you know, all of us are creative, but we don't have to be creative in the identical manner. So I play jazz guitar pretty well. I've been playing for 40 years. I can't draw a stick figure if I tried. And you don't want to see me anywhere near a dance floor. So often someone might say, well, I'm in legal and I don't play music, so therefore I'm not creative. But you know, there's been brilliant legal minds that are wildly creative, whether you're convincing a jury of an argument or whether you're drafting a document. You know, we can all apply creativity in our own ways. And I would say that, you know, the organization that has 10,000 people and only 16 are allowed to be creative, really is there's an undercurrent there that could bump into some hard times. Because if your competition has all 10,000 people being creative, who do you think is going to win over time? And so I think, in fact, one of the greatest leverage points of an organization to create sustainable success is to create a almost like a greenhouse, to create ideal conditions and leaders who foster others' creativity. You're unlocking this incredibly powerful natural resource that translates to competitive advantage. So those that truly embrace it will thrive. Those that don't may really run some serious risk in the future.
And I think it's really helpful to make sure that people understand what creativity is, or where it's limited or where it's not limited, so to speak. Like you said, it's not just in product development. It's not just in marketing. It can be anywhere. And recognizing that even somebody having the idea of moving a trash can, you know, 20 feet to make it more efficient for other people, that's creative. Or a company who says, we're not going to have Zoom meetings on Friday for this reason, that's creative too.
Absolutely right. So creativity can take lots of shapes and forms. But when we harness them, simply put, when we harness it, we get better outcomes. And those outcomes can be in all the things that we care about, whether it's, again, boosting sales for a sales force, whether it's, you know, better serving customers to improve customer loyalty, or whether it's your health or your family or your community. So just think about it as this superpower that we all have. It's funny, as human beings, we can't fly. We don't have X-ray vision, but we all can be creative. And when we develop those skills, it just yields a better set of outcomes.
It really does. So now that we've established that it doesn't have to be just the innovation team and their fancy satellite office, it can be everybody on every floor. And we've established that there's some of those eight core obsessions for innovation. So how can teams work with each other to come up with creative ideas? I remember from my career, a lot of times when we wanted to have an idea, we would hole up in a conference room and we'd have a brainstorming session and say, okay, who has ideas? Let's share your ideas. Is there a better way?
So I'm so glad you asked that question. So let's go back for one second. 1958, a number of new technologies came on the scene. The first magnetic tape for storage, the Rolodex to keep track of your contacts, the first video game, which was like this little green screen tennis game that you couldn't even tell it was tennis. And this bold new technology came on the scene 1958 for idea extraction, called brainstorming. So now fast forward to 2021. You don't use magnetic tape. You could store the entire Library of Congress on a thumb drive. You don't use a Rolodex because you've got LinkedIn. Tennis games look as realistic and 3D as the real thing, yet we're still using the same outdated, ineffective technology of brainstorming. So I would suggest, with great love and respect, that we all need to upgrade our technology if we want to upgrade our creative output. And so in the book, and also with a supplemental website that readers can enjoy, I've over the years developed a much stronger set of technologies for brainstorming. And they're much more fun. They're a little bit playful, some of them, but they really yield much more powerful ideas. And I'd be happy to share a couple if that's helpful.
Oh, please do.
One of them that I love is called role storming. So role storming is brainstorming in character. You're pretending that you're somebody else. Here's the thing. Brainstorming is a perfect exercise to yield mediocre ideas. And the reason is because fear enters the equation. And fear turns out not natural talent, but fear is the single biggest blocker of creativity. So Matt, let's say you're in a brainstorm session and you have some crazy idea that's not fully baked. Well, it's too risky for you to share it. What if you get laughed at? What if your boss doesn't like it? What if you upset the apple cart, blah, blah, blah. So what we tend to do is we share our safe ideas, not our big ideas, because we're like responsible for them. Role storming solves that. So now, instead of you brainstorming as Matt, let's say you're role storming as Steve Jobs. Well, nobody's going to laugh at Steve for coming up with a big idea. They might laugh at Steve for coming up with a small one. So now you, AKA Steve Jobs, are totally liberated. You can say anything you want, no fear of retribution. So the technique is actually really simple. Everybody just chooses any character they want to be. You could be a movie star, you could be a sports hero, you could be a villain. And you pretend that you are that person as you tackle a real world challenge, and you will be blown away. The simple technique, how the ideas flow. I did this with a group of executives one time at Sony Japan. I met this guy. He was like the stiffest human being I've ever met. Dark suit, white shirt, tie is all tight. Anyway, we got this guy role storming as Yoda. And I've never seen personal transformation like this. This guy's jacket's undone. His tie is off. He's like leaping around the room. And the whiteboards were filled with ideas. Thing is, I didn't teach him to be creative. He had that inside him all along, as do all of us. But the role he was in forbid it. We put him in a new role and he was able to be wildly creative very quickly. So anyway, there's 13 techniques like that I share. And what we've learned is we've seen people who self-identify as not creative, not having a creative bone in their body, very quickly with some better technique, better technology, bring fascinating and powerful and magical ideas to the surface.
That really helps. And when you can place yourself in somebody else's shoes, you know, in a different role, I think it helps you to shed those barriers of fear or nervousness or that risk of sharing what may be a dumb idea to you.
Yeah, exactly right. And speaking of dumb ideas, you know, the challenge is that we believe that we should be judging and assessing ideas as they come out of our mouths. And that's really a shame because, first of all, ideas that are not fully baked often get extinguished prematurely. But second of all, sometimes it's the idea that leads to the idea that leads to the idea that really becomes the winner. And if we crush ideas too soon, that's problematic. Maybe you've noticed this. Typical brainstorming session, you've got five people in the room. One person shares an idea and the other four become the self-appointed idea police. They tell you all the reasons it's not going to work and it won't fit in the PowerPoint deck and the boss will never go for it. And so this premature extinguishing is really problematic. One thing that I talk about in the book is that I actually changed some of the language. I almost like taking an idea as a unit and putting that under the microscope and deconstructing it and saying, okay, what are the components? What's the anatomy of an idea? And so if you think about it, actually, what I like to do is call those first initial thoughts, as I call them, a spark instead of an idea, because an idea, by the nature of it, we say, okay, it's ready for evaluation and judgment. But a spark is sort of obvious. It's not a fully baked idea. It's the beginning. It's a tadpole. And so I like, instead of saying, okay, let's come up with ideas, because again, we think that they should be subject to scrutiny. I like the idea of let's come up with sparks. Because sparks, you're not saying, oh, this is the perfect solution. You're just saying, hey, this is the beginning. What if we did this? What if we did that? So it takes, again, some of the pressure off when you reframe the language.
And I think it can make it easier for anybody else who either wants to criticize or provide feedback on that spark. It helps them turn it around in their head to make a better connection to that spark. So instead of squashing that spark, you can say, here's how to make that spark work.
Totally. And by the way, we also tend to commingle two discrete activities when we quote unquote brainstorm. We commingle the ideation process, which is just, you know, coming up with ideas, and then the execution process, saying, okay, which ideas work? How should we effectuate them? How do we put them into action? And the problem is that in our society, we have very well-developed analytical brains, logic, reason, et cetera, and generally speaking, fairly underdeveloped creative brains. So what ends up happening is that when we come up with those little ideas, we then pounce into execution mode and crush them. So my suggestion is that when we're doing an ideation session, I like to call them idea jamming, by the way, instead of brainstorming. But if you're doing an idea jam session, send your linear logical brain out to Starbucks. Like, get out of the room. Don't come back until I invite you back. And in that session, if you generate 500 ideas and 490 of them suck, who cares? Who cares? You know, it's not like they all have to be perfect. In fact, they rarely are. But you have to give yourself and your team the creative freedom to let any and everything come out from your mind and put it onto the whiteboards. Later on, you can evaluate them as you should. Like afterwards, step two, your logical brain comes back from Starbucks. Then you're like, okay, which of these ideas makes sense? Which ones merit further exploration? How are we going to test them? How could we prototype them? So all those are great questions to ask. It's just that we should separate into two distinct parts of the process.
That makes a lot of sense. Because if you start trying to figure out how to execute as those ideas are coming out, you're going to squash some of those ideas. And then you might not get to those 490 ideas that lead to those really great 10 ideas.
That's exactly right. And the other thing too is, you know, when we look at masterpieces from people in art and business, you know, we think that they just had the idea and they popped out of the shower and it was perfectly manifest. And that's just not how it works. No. You know, I did a piece one time on Picasso. He's got like, I'm gonna get the numbers wrong, but directionally it's right. He created something like 140,000 pieces of art in his lifetime. And of those, I don't remember the exact number, but there was like 20 that are considered true masterpieces and another 80 or whatever that are considered, you know, pretty darn good. So, but if you just do the math, I mean, 100, let's say, fine works of art out of 147,000 attempts, and that's Picasso we're talking about. So why should we hold ourselves to some level of perfectionism that every idea we think of should be perfect? By the way, that get back to the big little breakthroughs notion. You know, when you practice small ideas, again, they're way less risky, but you're building skill. You know, we look at the Mona Lisa from Da Vinci and say the greatest work ever, but that wasn't his first painting. Like he had to first learn to paint. He had to paint every day. He had to learn how to make bad paintings. He had to screw stuff up. And over time, he refined his art and created the masterpiece. So let's give ourselves that same sense of permission. If we want to create a masterpiece, the best thing we can do to start is pick up a brush and start painting.
And you can't just wait for that inspiration to strike. You know, like you said, Picasso and the thousands and thousands of pieces that he painted, you know, Da Vinci having to learn how to paint and like being able to get that master, or even, you know, back to the 10,000 hour principle. Back when we had live music, I was at a pre-concert Q&A session with the band, The Hold Steady, and their lead singer, Craig Venn, said something super interesting to me. It was so fascinating. He said that he doesn't wait for inspiration to start writing songs. He has to keep writing songs all the time. And some of the things that he writes, they're not going to be good at all, and they may not make it. But the fact that he's in that habit, in that regular process, helps to get to those songs that do make it.
Yeah, that's really well said. You know, the other thing it's important to note is that sometimes we don't recognize that greatness comes through not just some initial burst of inspiration from the gods, but through refinement. There's a great line that what do all great authors have in common? And the answer is lousy first drafts. And so the point is, like, you have to get stuff out there and then you really shape and refine it. I talk in the book about Lady Gaga, who she made a great comment one time. She said, you know, when I write a song, it's sort of like 15 minutes of me vomiting my ideas onto the page, and it's terrible. And then it could take me 2 years of refinement to get that song right before I release it. And so let's, again, give ourselves some permission in that process. Best thing I can suggest, though, is when we build rituals and rewards and techniques, it makes all this much easier. Like if I said, go cut a football field of the grass using a scissors, that would kind of be a pain. If I gave you a riding mower, it'd be a lot easier. So let's rely on some systems and processes and rituals to help. One thing that's kind of fun, just because you're talking about music, Aerosmith does something cool. So they actually have a meeting. It's called the Dare to Suck meeting. So the band gets together, and the whole point is to share something, an idea, a crazy idea that sucks. And sometimes they have ideas that really suck. But because of meetings like that ritual, they were able to land on Dude Look Like a Lady. I mean, who would have been able to come up with that without giving yourself the permission, essentially, to suck? The other thing I would just quickly say in terms of rituals, there's a fun one. One of the guys I interviewed in the book is this really cool guy, runs a nonprofit in the UK, and he does a fun ritual. I was asking him, how does he get his team to stay creative and continue to take responsible risks and, you know, not be worried so much about making mistakes? So he does this thing. It's a ritual every Friday. It's called F Up Fridays. I mean, he says the whole word. I'll be PG here today, but yeah. F Up Fridays. So what they do is they have this big brown bag lunch with this entire 50 person team, and they go around the room one by one, and everyone stands up and says, here's what I effed up this week, and here's what I learned from it. And they're not sharing it like in a scarlet letter kind of way. It's a badge of honor. And then when they finally get in the meeting to someone who didn't F something up that week, they're like, well, why not? What are you going to try next week? So the simple ritual, I mean, think about the message that sends deep into the DNA of this organization about taking responsible risks, and that being a creator is, in fact, part of the gig.
And that helps take out a lot of that personal risk that we can assign when we may have a great idea, but think, oh my goodness, I couldn't do that. Or that may be a great idea, but if it fails, I'll get fired. No, I mean, having an F up Friday, you know, like that helps show everybody that it's okay to do that.
Yeah. Crucially, fear and creativity cannot coexist. So one of the most important jobs that leaders need to do is think about, how can I create a safe environment where all ideas are celebrated, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Another person that I've covered, there's a company that issues every team member 2 corporate get out of jail free cards every year. And here's what they say. They say, look, you know, creativity is part of the gig. You know, we expect you to be innovative. And as such, you're going to make a mistake. And so instead of you being worried about it, when you screw something up, hand us one of these cards and you're off the hook. No questions asked. And in fact, on the annual reviews, a leader will be disappointed with a team member if they haven't used both of them. Yeah. Now, on the one hand, you might be saying, gosh, that sounds so risky. But I would say, with respect, what's the risk of not doing something like that? Irrelevance? Mediocrity? Getting passed by? It's funny. So many people, they live their lives trying to play it safe, only to learn that that's probably the riskiest thing you can do.
It is, because the world is always evolving. Customer expectations are always changing. And if you stay the same, the world and their expectations are going to pass you by.
That's exactly right. You know, if we live in a vacuum, it would be one thing. But now we're living in a rate of change like none other in history. So again, clinging to old models of success is a real trap. And you may have remembered in the book, I grew up playing video games in the 80s. I know I'm dating myself, but there was this game called Frogger. And, oh, yeah. And in the game, if maybe not everyone knows the game, but like you're this little frog and your goal is to cross the river. The problem is this frog can't swim. So he has to jump on the back of solid surfaces that are moving in the river. So there's like a log going by or an alligator or a lily pad. And you have to jump on the back of these things in order to cross the river. But once you land on a solid surface, like if you're on the back of a log, if you just stay on the log, you fall in the river and die. And so I think that's actually a perfect metaphor. We're literally like living in a giant game of Frogger. In other words, as we land on a point of success, if we just stay there, that's really a problem. We have to keep kind of like the frog leaping forward. I just call it the Frogger principle in the book. But when we win, let's celebrate it. Let's enjoy it. Let's spike the ball. But let's not stay on that log too long. Let's make sure that we're always leaping forward.
Right. Because if you stay on the log, you know, you'll get to the other end of the screen and you get squashed or you die. In real life, if you create something and you stick with that one solution, again, if you stick with it, it can die. And the longer that you go without changing it, the more you're probably going to have to change it once you get to that point of no return. And so that's why I think it helps to have those big little breakthroughs that can help you evolve that solution or that experience instead of having to like completely strip it down and rethink it once it's too late.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the funny thing though is that sometimes, you know, we think that an idea has to be really big and risky for it to be valuable. But there have been many cases that we cover in the book of little teeny ideas that turned out to be kind of like really successful. In other words, you can take less risk and still enjoy meaningful outcomes. So there's one of the principles that I cover in the book is called don't forget the dinner mint.
Right.
And I'm sure you've been to a nice restaurant at the end of your meal. Here's some nice chocolates, compliments of the chef. And because it's surprise and unexpected, and it's this cool extra little thing, it completely changes your experience of the meal. So I call this principle, don't forget the dinner mint, the notion of adding to any piece of work product, even a little bit extra creativity, just a little bit, like under 5% more. But that extra dose, that extra little nuance or flourish can yield a disproportionately large result. So a fun example of that in action, there's this woman named Melissa Tabs, and she came, her family was in the ice cream business back in Italy. She came to the United States and she wanted to open up an ice cream shop in New York. Well, talk about competitive. Like, how do you compete with a commodity like vanilla ice cream? So instead, she decided to embrace this dinner mint strategy. She says, okay, is there something extra I could add just a little bit, like less than 5% to really make my ice cream different? So she comes up with this great idea and she's gone on to make booze infused ice cream. So she actually, again, less than 5% of the overall weight, but she has these amazing flavors like dark chocolate, whiskey, salted caramel ice cream and cake batter vodka martini ice cream. And it proportionally, it's just a little extra something. But as a result, her success is remarkable. She has two stores in New York. She's got a best-selling cookbook. She does corporate catering. She ships her ice cream to all 50 states. And it was all because instead of just selling the same vanilla that everybody else does, and even if it was good quality is just the ante to play. But she added that little extra twist of creativity. And now she's the only like booze-infused ice cream. And here we are talking about her instead of somebody else who just offers a commodity.
And she could have taken the route that a lot of business owners think you should take is, okay, here's ice cream. Here's the competitive landscape for ice cream. How can I make my ice cream better than theirs? How can I make it taste better, higher quality? But what we are starting to see is that different is better than better. And ice cream infused with booze is different from any other ice cream out there. So different ice cream is better than a better ice cream.
That's exactly right. And I maybe forgot to mention it, but it's called Tipsy Scoop ice cream, in case you're curious.
Oh, that's right. Yep. Tipsy Scoop. Well, and a lot of times when people are coming up with innovative ideas, they're coming up with the ideas from their own perspective. How can they make sure that the innovative idea, especially if it's for a new product or a new service, how can they make sure that their innovative idea is something that customers actually want?
This is a great question because too often we do it wrong. In other words, we as the decision maker, CEO, owner, whatever, you know, come up with some idea. We think it's right. Maybe you have conviction, but it's a total miss. So a more productive approach is actually experimentation. So instead of, you know, the person with the loudest voice in the room gets to make all the decisions, I would recommend, so let's say we're thinking about ice cream ideas. And let's say we brainstorm 50 of them, and then we narrowed it down to 5. Well, instead of just the boss chooses and you go and you hope you get it right, I'd rather you go out there and experiment and test all 5. And let's bring all 5 to customers and see what they think. If customers tend to favor 2 of the 5, then now you've got 2, and let's do more tests. And so if you actually think of innovation as a series of experiments rather than one, you know, bet everything on an idea, it's way less risky. I mean, think about how drug therapies are created. So thank God we have a COVID vaccine. But it wasn't like some guy in a corner office woke up one day and was like, I've got it, Eureka, let's go print a billion copies of this vaccine. Of course not. They'd lock the guy up. Instead, they go into a lab, and a lab is a safe environment, and they tested a whole bunch of stuff. And I'm sure they narrowed it down to hundreds of ones that showed promise, and they ran more tests, and they kept refining it. And by the time it got out, now it's in people's arms, that was a much more productive approach to get it right. And that's exactly what we should do with our product ideas, our marketing ideas, our safety ideas, our efficiency ideas, any place we're using creativity. The best approach is to, once you come up with an idea, come up with multiple ideas, figure out with the ones that you like, how can you prototype or test those ideas as fast and cheap as you possibly can, and quickly discard the ones that don't work out in a test, and the ones that do, start doubling down on the ones that do. And by the time you actually release something, you have way more confidence that you're going to get it right.
It's like an ongoing process of testing and learning, and then applying your learnings, and then evolving it, and then testing it again and learning again and applying those learnings until you have like that really big thing.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't cover in the book, I cover stories because we already know that like Apple is innovative and Netflix is innovative. So I really didn't cover, I like to uncover stories that we don't know. But the one mention I made of Jeff Bezos in the book wasn't about Amazon per se, because we already know they're innovative, but he had a good comment. He said that, you know, their success at Amazon is directly correlated to the number of experiments they run on a daily, weekly, monthly, and annual basis. And I think that's a good way to think of it, that as leaders, we should always be running little experiments, knowing full well that like 80% of them will fail, but that's just part of the process. In fact, if you are running experiments all the time, the optimal number of failed experiments is not 0. In other words, if you have 0 failed experiments, then you're not pushing the boundaries enough. You're barely trying. So I know it's very different than we've been taught in school, like never make a mistake, and mistakes are fatal. But I think there's a lot of beauty in doing that, because the more experiments you run, just like Jeff Bezos said, the more successful you will become.
Yeah. And I think that's what's going to help for leaders to understand how to create that and instill that in their culture, is to encourage constant experimentation. That's beautiful. Well, Josh, I've got one last question for you that I ask most of my guests. If you were to create a 5-song soundtrack for Big Little Breakthroughs, what songs would you include?
I love this question because, you know, you and I both are deeply passionate about music. So here's my 5. The first one would be Giant Steps, which is a song by John Coltrane. It's a very intense jazz song. And the reason I like that is that he literally broke the rules. Like there's certain mechanical rules when you're composing music, and he pushed it as far from those rules as you could go. So it is, I won't get into all the details of it, but it is from a scale from 1 to 10, he pushed a 10 in terms of breaking the rules, and it became his most famous song, and it's fantastic. So I like the idea of being a bit of a troublemaker. And so Giant Steps would be number 1 from John Coltrane. Number 2 is the Frank Sinatra tune, Come Fly With Me. And that's what this book is all about. It's like, hey, let's do this together. It's not preachy. It's not wagging your finger at somebody. It's like, hey, let's do it. Like, let's team up. Let's get more creative. Let's win together. Let's allow everyday people to become everyday innovators. Number 3 is that song by Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop. Because I think we do, we can get derailed quickly. The slightest sign of setback, we go running to the hills of safety. And I would just encourage people to really persist. And if they continue to persist, developing their creative muscle, as we talked about earlier, they're going to enjoy great outcomes. Number 4, Eye of the Tiger, 80s classic, but there's that sense of grit and determination. And I just think that translates really well to business and life. I'm a big fan of, you don't have to come from the fanciest background or fancy degrees or be from a certain race or gender or age or whatever, but if you have enough grit, you can accomplish a lot. And so I like that one. And then finally, from the legend, Paul Simon, still crazy after all these years. And I kind of love that. Like, don't you, why wouldn't you want to be a little crazy? How cool is that? People often ask me, what's my title? And I usually respond with creative troublemaker. And I like that, not because I want to hurt people, like, you know, bad trouble, but I like making good trouble. I like being a little crazy. And someone who's willing to make trouble is someone who's willing to challenge conventional wisdom and imagine what's possible instead of just what is. So I hope that we can all, with a smile, still be crazy after all these years.
Love it. Yeah, it's the troublemakers. It's the crazy ones. It's the people that make big waves are the ones that get big things done.
And awesome. And those are the ones that we remember too. You know, well, who do you remember? You don't remember the guy that played it safe and sat in his awkward, you know, cubicle all the day and never took a risk. You remember, like, who are our heroes? Thomas Edison and Martin Luther King Jr. and you know, Oprah, like people who did big, bold things. They weren't the people that did what they were told. They pushed the boundaries. And so I think that there's a real opportunity for all of us in our own ways to do just the same.
And you're not going to have those impacts without taking the risks and without experimenting. Well, Josh, we've learned a lot here, but where can we go to learn more about Big Little Breakthroughs?
Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate the conversation. I would encourage people to check out biglittlebreakthroughs.com. If you want to buy a book, great. But even if you don't, there's actually a whole set of resources there that are free. There's a free creativity assessment where people can sort of jump on the scale and see how they're weighing in. There's downloadable worksheets. There's a quick start guide. There's brainstorming tools, all kinds of goodies. So yeah, check it out at biglittlebreakthroughs.com. And I really do encourage people, whether you read the book or not, to just, you know, consider pushing your creative boundaries a little bit. We upgrade our wardrobe, we upgrade our car and our iPhone. Why can't we upgrade our creativity? And even a small upgrade will go a long way.
Oh yeah. I would highly encourage anybody, of course, get the book. There's lots of awesome stories in there and explanations around everything we just talked about. And then as a supplement, yes, all the tools that you mentioned at biglittlebreakthroughs.com, the assessment, the different toolkits that can help teams walk through all these different exercises. And then there's a whole library of videos too that can help you. Lots of fantastic resources. Well, Josh, thank you so much. Thanks for being here today.
Truly my pleasure. Thanks for making a big impact in the world as well. And I look forward to staying in close touch.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Josh Linkner. So go check out his book, Big Little Breakthroughs, and go visit biglittlebreakthroughs.com. You'll find lots of exercises and content and videos that are going to help you and your team strengthen your own creative muscles. And if you're enjoying the Simple Brand Podcast, go ahead, hit that subscribe button. It's going to make it a lot simpler for you to get future episodes like the next one featuring Greg McEwen. Greg is the New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestselling author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And he has a new book coming out titled Effortless, Make It Easier to Do What Matters Most. You're really going to want to hear this episode because Greg and I completely threw away the interview and we turned it into an essentialism intervention where Greg literally coaches me on my business and helps me prioritize my approach. So go ahead and subscribe. You'll automatically get Greg's episode as soon as it's live. Until then, keep it simple.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Simple Brand Podcast. Want to make your listening experience simple and automatically receive each new episode? Visit our website, simplebrandpodcast.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. If you're finding value from the Simple Brand Podcast, leave us a rating or review. That helps us get the show to the ears of the people who need it most. Be sure to catch Matt right here next week. Same Matt time, same Matt channel. Until then, keep it simple.